Hi, everybody. Welcome to episode 6. We're so excited to be back again. Again, this week, it's just me and Nick. Ray is still doing other stuff, but she will be back as soon as she can be. So today we're going to talk about all the stuff that happened this week, and we're not 3 weeks late like last week's episode. So to kick us off, we're going to start with the Ocean Cleanup Project. Many of you might have heard of this. It's run by a guy named Boyan Slat. He's a young guy. He is an entrepreneur. All the media loves him. But it turns out a lot of ocean plastic pollution experts do not love him. So what Boyan Slat did is he developed this company, right? It's a company. And they have this big machine that goes around the ocean, or is supposed to go around the ocean, and picks up plastic in the ocean. And most people don't like this, at least in the science community. So there's an article that interviewed 15 ocean plastic pollution experts. It sent out surveys, and a majority of these ocean plastic pollution experts had major concerns about the Ocean Cleanup Project. Some said it was a waste of money. A lot of people said that it was more complicated. The ocean plastic issue was more complicated than the Ocean Cleanup Project makes it out to be. Apparently, they didn't do an environmental impact assessment before starting the project. They started it years in, which is, frankly, not really acceptable. You're supposed to do it before you start a project. A majority of these experts think that this machine will kill marine life, or they have major, major concerns about that fact. And a majority feel that this guy, Boyan Slat, has extreme misunderstandings about the key issues with ocean plastics, and not a single one would unreservedly call him an expert in ocean plastic pollution. Some people said that he is perpetuating misconceptions and he isn't focused on the larger problem of microplastics. They say this machine doesn't pick up the microplastics, it only picks up the big stuff. And then one of the big issues here, and one of the big disagreements, is what's better? Is it prevention better or cleanup better? Not a single one of these experts said that cleanup is best. Some people said prevention is better than cleanup, and some people said a mixture is best. I have a personal analogy that cleaning up the ocean plastic in just the ocean and just doing that is basically like helping someone with a stab wound by just sponging up the blood on the floor instead of stopping the blood from coming out. You're not really doing much. You're cleaning it up. It's still coming out. It's coming out in a flood. It's coming out faster than you can clean it up. So kind of what's the point? You got to do both, or you got to do prevention. A lot of these people also feel that the media coverage of the Ocean Cleanup Project has been inaccurate or has major errors in the coverage. And that's a big problem. We can't be perpetuating these misconceptions in our media. We need to take charge of that and stop supporting these projects that might not be what we need. It might be a waste of money. One of the big quotes that I really liked by the author was just said, trying to help is not the same thing as helping. And essentially, we just need to think through these projects and what we're spending money on and see if we're using our money in the best way possible.
Yeah, to provide some context, Kim Martini and Miriam Goldstein with Deep Sea News have been writing extensively about the Ocean Cleanup Project over the years. And I hope they were involved in this survey as well. We know from anecdotal evidence that the Ocean Cleanup Project folks sent out like 200-page reports to a handful of ocean experts and told them to review all 200 of these pages with, I think it was like a 48-hour turnaround time without any financial compensation either, I mean, it was just like completely laughable. They also, you know, so that the way the cleanup project works, right, is that they're supposed to be mounting this conveyor belt contraption to the seafloor. And they want to put these things out in the middle of the open ocean at depths that not even an oil rig has ever been put at before. So just like the technology for anchoring these things in the ground just does not exist yet. In addition to that, they have been using in their testing booms that are colored black. So they're just these black booms out in dark water that are not otherwise marked in any way. So this is a severe hazard to navigation that, you know, could legitimately imperil lives. There's also no mechanism to prevent the conveyor belt contraption from collecting fish or other marine life as well. So there are, you know, known impacts that this will cause on marine life. And basically all of these concerns over the years have just been completely ignored or thrown out by the Ocean Cleanup Project folks. And despite all this, they've been getting lots and lots of great PR all over the years. And, you know, I know every time I talk about the, you know, Great Pacific Garbage Patch, people always think, you know, it's an island and that boy in Slatch is going to go clean it all up. And it's like, ha, 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 no.
They have a wonderful PR team. You have to give them that. But yeah, scientists pretty much disagree with a large amount of what the Ocean Cleanup Project is doing.
Yeah. Yeah. And if you're curious, we actually have an interview we did a couple of years ago with Marcus Erickson, who I believe was with Five Gyres at the time, Nick Malos, the director of Trash Feces at Ocean Conservancy, John Davis, our boss, hosted that. And Boyan Slat was also in there, so he got to respond to some things. Didn't respond to a lot, but anyway, we'll see. he was a good yeah. sport. I have to give him that.
Yeah, we can put that in the show notes.
Yeah,
too.
Totally. So in other news, there's this cool news item that came out about this paper in PNAS called "Exploitation Drives an Autogenic Like Deepening in Marine Fish." So the news source was from Ars Technica. It was called Ecological Law, turns out just to be the result of fishing. So it turns out that big old fish go deeper because of fishing pressure. So the study looked at cod fishing off of Nova Scotia, where Canada put a moratorium on cod fishing in 1993 because the stock was depleted. So if you look at the data and you model this from 1992, so the data from 1992 show that codfish, large codfish, were only found in deeper, colder waters. Which for a while, the thought process in the scientific community was that large fish were found in deeper waters because of the cold and because of nutrients or because they were shunned by their other fish friends. But if you look at the data from 2006 to 2010, when there was no fishing at all, you could see that there were both big and small fish living in little fish harmony in shallow depths. So it's pretty clear from this study and the modeling they did with it, comparing that to like actual fishing records, that the cause of big fish going deep is indeed because of human-induced fishing pressure. So, you know, the big fish are deeper because that's where they can avoid being fish and they're thus, you know, able to grow larger.
Another one of those kind of duh papers, like the last in episode 5, but still very, very important and something I never would have thought of. Yeah. So it's great to hear about
this. We love duh papers. They're the coolest.
Yeah, that's going to be our new term for all papers that say things that should be obvious but aren't. So for continuing in this fisheries trend, another paper came out about the use of aquatic mammals for bait in global fisheries. Not sure if you guys knew that happened. I definitely didn't before I read this paper. So apparently, because I didn't know and a lot of people don't know, we don't pay much attention in the conservation and science communities to the use of aquatic mammals as bait in global fisheries. So this paper did the authors of this paper did a review of lit since 1970 on this practice. And apparently this practice has been around and continues to be around, and it affects at least 42 species of marine mammals. And often these fishers are killing these animals specifically to use them for that bait. So it's not bycatch. Sometimes it is, but a lot of them are not. One of the main fisheries that uses this bait is shark fisheries that use long lines. And it's most common in Asia and Latin America. There's little info on the impact to the populations of marine mammals or of, I guess, the fisheries that they're catching the fish out of, but there seems to be a negative impact, which seems fairly obvious. If you kill a bunch of more marine mammals, there's going to be less of them, and it's hard for them to reproduce and keep going in our current ocean climate. And essentially, this paper says that we need to do more monitoring, and if we are going to develop approaches to mitigate these negative effects, then we really need to think about why these fishermen and why these fisheries use these aquatic mammals as bait in the first place. So we need to take into account culture. We need to take into account if it's a better way to catch these fish, we need to take into account all sorts of things to make these mitigation techniques effective.
Yeah, gosh, I had no idea anybody was using marine mammals for bait. That is just, oh, that's sad.
Kind of blew my mind when I saw it. I was like, wait a minute, that shouldn't be allowed, but I guess it happens. We need to think about it, I guess. Time to bring that to light.
So I have two Markhive summaries to talk about that are really interesting. The first one is perceptions of social impacts likely drive feelings about MPAs, although I came up with a much better title the other day, which would be your consultation process might be what's making people hate your MPA. So the authors of this study looked at the Jurien Bay Marine Park, which is located 200 kilometers north of Perth, Australia. So this is a multi-use MPA that was declared in 2003. And in 2005, six zone types were added through an iterative consultation process with local stakeholder groups and a community advisory committee. So the authors used semi-structured interviews with 50 members of these groups and representatives to try to figure out, you know, what the social impacts of the park were to these stakeholders. So the authors found that positive impacts from establishment of the park were reported more often by those who use the park for non-extractive purposes, like recreational activities in the tourism industry. And these positive impacts were mostly looking at long-term benefits, like how people thought the park would attract more tourism and raise more awareness about the marine environment. The authors also determined that individuals across all stakeholder groups held negative attitudes towards the marine park in some form or another. Usually these were negative attitudes towards the management agencies. However, for those who reported feelings of injustice or inequality, negative attitudes were usually held towards the decision-making and consultation process itself. Negative impacts were almost exclusively reported by those who used the park for extractive purposes, and no stakeholders who experienced significant negative impacts recognized any environmental benefits. It's important to note that increased financial costs were only reported by two people in this study, and they were both commercial fishers. However, fishers usually described continually watching their locations while on the water to prevent fishing in the wrong zone by mistake, making fishing a less enjoyable experience. The community consultation process itself may have also helped to breed negative feelings towards the park. So the recreational fishing industry representatives reported strong feelings of injustice and inequality, as the commercial lobster fishing industry was able to lobby for regulations that allowed for unfettered access to lobster harvesting. And a member of the community advisory committee put it best that, quote, having a dozen people all with different views sitting in a room arguing about squares on a map is not only ineffective in achieving the objectives they all really want, but it's awfully damaging. And, you know, I mean, this totally makes sense. You know, I mean, if you're in a room with a bunch of people and, you know, one group gets, you know, out basically scot-free on regulations when everybody else has to get regulated, and they only get out scot-free because they have a mass lobbying effort, you know, that's not exactly fair or equal by any means. So, you know, when these types of interactions, you know, are held openly and everybody else can see, you know, exactly the kind of injustice that goes on in the world, then obviously people don't think that's fair. I think a lot of people would say, like, hi, welcome to America, except this is in Australia. But anyway, you know, it's really sad. It just goes to show you, you know, what special interest groups, the power that they have in, you know, affecting change, and just how, you know, handouts to these special interest groups really negatively affect everyone, except for, of course, those special interest groups. So,
well, I have nothing to add.
Yeah, in less depressing Markhive summary. So this one was a happy one, which is why we're ending on this note. So this Markhive summary was positive feedback between participation and MPA performance in the Philippines. So the authors surveyed residents from 15 villages in the Philippines, totaling 214 individuals, to examine what factors led to participation in an MPA planning and ongoing management process. So the authors developed a model based on this survey, which you can see in the paper and obviously in the summary, illustrating positive feedback loops. So the model suggests that participation can educate users about the environment and how the MPA provides benefits. And those participation levels were both strongly and positively correlated with perceived MPA performance. Now, previous research has shown that users who self-identify with nature are more likely to engage in pro-environmental behaviors, and this finding was confirmed by this study. It was also shown that participation was more likely amongst those who were experiencing food and income insecurity, which is very interesting because, you know, it's clear that these groups have a lot to gain from the MPA, you know, providing benefits, and a lot to lose if the MPA just excludes them from, you know, being able to get food. So, you know, it's very nice to see that these groups that are going to be directly impacted by the MPA were indeed participating. So basically, in short, the study found that better engagement leads to better perceptions of success in this case. So it's hopefully provides some hope for everybody else out there. You know, if you have a really good, you know, engagement effort, hopefully more people will see the value and the success of your MPA, particularly if those people are engaged, you know, long-term monitoring and management of the MPA, and they can actually see how the MPA is making things improve, which hopefully it is making things improve.
Let's hope.
Fingers crossed.
All right. Well, great. That concludes episode 6 of Octopod. We've had a lot of fun so far, and we hope to see you guys next week. Please, again, go and leave us comments, leave us reviews, tell your friends. We'd really appreciate it. And bye for now.
Bye.